Right. Now I'm going to ask both of the main speakers to wind up about 5 minutes or so each. First of all, Adam Beer, Socialist.
Okay, thank you, Conor. I'm normally quite a patient man, unlike my comrade Coleman, but I myself am getting a bit fed up of people going on and on in this meeting here, telling the miners what they should do. I mean, we in the Socialist Party of Great Britain, we're members of the working class and we're responsible people. What we do is we argue with miners. Well, in fact, we don't need to argue with miners because there are miners who are members of the Socialist Party. What we do when there's a strike like the miners' strike is we use the incidents that happen and we argue, this is what capitalism is like, this is the cause of your problems, this is the solution. That is what, I don't like the word intervention, but that, if you like, is our intervention. I'll be quite frank. That is as far as I personally am prepared to go. If you yourself are prepared to throw bricks at the police, if you're prepared to take an air gun and shoot at the police, do it. But don't come to us and tell us to do that. I mean, I say that's a responsibility of, you know, the workers themselves, because there are kids there. I got a copy of the miner, and there's some poor kid of 18. He's in a Borstal. He's allowed to be in prison now for the next 10 years. You take that responsibility. You go and tell, you know, working class kids and miners to, you know, throw things at the police and take pot shots at them. Yeah, either do it yourself, but I mean, don't have the insolence to do that. I mean, I personally am not prepared to do that. I don't suppose any member of the Socialist Party is. But obviously, we're on the side of the miners. And in fact, this comes back to the question of the police and the miners. Is a Nottinghamshire miner who works a member of the working class? Yes, there you are. But why is he any different from a policeman? Because he's also sabotaging the struggles of the miners. It isn't a question. You see, this is an idealist conception of what is a member of the working class. Right from the start, I mean, we had a lesson in materialism. I defined what we meant by a member of the working class. A member of the working class is somebody who is forced by economic necessity to go out and to sell his ability to work to an employer for a wage of a salary, irrespective of what job. It doesn't matter what his ideas is. He can be a Tory, he can be a policeman, he can be a fascist, he can have all sorts of reactionary ideas. That doesn't make any basic position, any basic difference to his position as a member of the working class. But to come back to the subject which we were debating this evening, can the majority of workers develop socialist consciousness under capitalism? And having listened to the debate, I think we're quite right to say the debate is, are the workers thick? Are the workers thick? Because we argue from this side that, as far as we can see, there is nothing to prevent a majority of workers coming to want and understand socialism. The people on this side have said, well, I could quote it, it is impossible for a majority of workers to come to socialist, or as they call it, communist consciousness within capitalism. But, they say, it is possible for a minority. I put the question I put at the beginning. Why is it possible for this minority? What is so special about this minority? The only answer is that somehow they are, I don't know, must be, they are more intelligent, or they are more educated than the rest of the workers. That's the only possible answer that they can give. They must say there's something special about us which cuts us off and marks us apart from the rest of the working class. And to answer the question which did come up, how can socialism be achieved? How will it be achieved? You know, what can we do to achieve it? Now, one of the myths that was put over here, that we in the Socialist Party somehow believe that this is merely a question of putting an X on a ballot paper and somehow there'll be some legislators who are going to legislate socialism into existence. I don't know whether any of the supporters of the CWO or the ICC or any other vanguard has in fact ever read a piece of election literature put out by the Socialist Party of Britain. To listen to them, you would imagine there's a photo of the candidate with his life story and his kids and what school he went to and a big thing saying, vote for us. If you elect us, we will introduce socialism for you. But this is, I take three by chance here. This is one that was issued in 1980 on the occasion of a by-election in Southend of all places. It says, after describing what socialism is, we know it is a lot to take in at one go and do not think that the Socialist Party can establish it for you. It'll only come when you and the majority want it. There's another one here, but earlier, 1973, it was the Great London Council elections when there were 14 or so socialist candidates. Socialism cannot be introduced by waving a magic political wand. It'll be the outcome of understanding and hard work. Your understanding and your hard work. And here's the one we put out at the GLC election again in 1981. This revolution, stop describing socialism again, this revolution from the inherent poverty of working class life to the freedom of a society in which we will be producing according to our abilities and take according to our self-defined needs is the only alternative to the misery and anarchy of the profit system. We cannot enact this great change on your behalf, for the liberation of the working class has to be carried out by the working class itself. In other words, when we contest elections, we're not putting ourselves up as leaders, and I suspect that the reason why the CWO, the ICC, and all the other vanguards can't understand what we're getting at is that they imagine that we've got the same conception of the role of a party as they have, but we want to do it on the electoral ground. But that, you know, that's not it at all. As I said, it's not us that is going to have to establish socialism. We're putting a proposition to the working class. They, in the end, are the only people that can establish socialism. I'd like to contrast the various passages I've just read with some things taken from the platform of the CWO, and you can judge for yourself who is insulting the working class. In here we're told the party's role is to assimilate lessons of the working class history and to turn these lessons to the class as well by giving both the political and practical lead to the class struggle. And here we talk about the role of the Communist Party is to contribute to the formation of the leading instrument of the proletariat's emancipation in order to lead future mass struggle. That's them offering themselves as leaders already three times. And it goes on and on. As the advance guard of the revolution, it is the party's task to organise and lead the insurrection at the most appropriate point. And then we're told that once the worker state, so-called, has been set up, the Communist Party must fight to win over the confused elements within the unitary bodies, that's a French word of some sort, to its programme. This means its members must clearly seek delegation on the basis of the party's programme. When the Communist Party dominates the state organs of a dynamic, etc., etc. So it's quite clear, these people are out to be leaders. It was said at the back, they are self-appointed leaders of the working class. And contrast that with the position which we've put forward, the emancipation of the working class must be the work of the working class itself. Now, on this question of how socialism will come about, well, if you look at it, we don't really know how socialism will come about. We don't really know how things develop, but we can form an idea of what is likely to happen. And I think, in fact, what is likely to happen is that socialist consciousness is likely to grow, but socialist consciousness isn't something abstract. It obviously takes a form of people organising in a socialist party, organising at their places of work. At a certain point in time, there will be the overwhelming majority of people who have become convinced socialists. So they'll be organised, as I say, at their places of work in trade unions or trade union or socialist unions or whatever, organised in a political party. In other words, the working class will be organised both industrially and politically in order to establish socialism. Now, our friends here are saying political organisation, no. Political organisation into a political party which puts up candidates and which tries to win a majority in Parliament. That is that. What they're saying, in fact, is that they should not do this. But I would make a remark which, in fact, was made by James Connolly. Now, James Connolly wasn't exactly a socialist, but for a certain period of time, he held views similar to those of the Socialist Party. In other words, he argued that the working class should organise industrially and politically to establish socialism. And he was a member of the IWW in America. Now, the IWW started off with this position that the workers should organise both politically and industrially. And in 1908, they cut out the need for political organisation from their constitution. Somebody asked James Connolly, who still held to his opposition, you know, what do you think of this? And he replied, You won't be able to stop the working class taking political action. And this is the reply I would give, that when a majority of workers have become convinced socialists, they naturally will organise politically. It's only now when we're at the stage of a sect, okay, we're a socialist sect, they're a super-Leninist state capitalist sect, but both of us, you know, when it comes down to it, we're sects. When the working class actually becomes socialist, you know, it's impossible that working class in the end, they'll be pragmatic. You know, why do we want to capture Parliament? Basically, the answer is because it's there. But the important thing is that what will establish socialism is not vote, it's not an X on a ballot paper, it's this. You know, the brain box, not the ballot box, as we can say. People must want and understand socialism. And when people want and understand socialism, they will, in the end, know what to do. And we think that, you know, I did make a list of things down here. I had civil war, armed mercenaries, economic chaos, imperialist war, insurrection. I mean, which century are we living in? Which century are we living in? Which century? I mean, this sort of stuff, well, it's a historical fantasy. It's just nonsense. We're living in a world where most of the industrial working class have acquired a trade union consciousness. They've acquired a democratic political consciousness. The next stage is to acquire a socialist consciousness. And when this happens, the means are there. The means are at hand. It's just a question of organising to put into being a democratic political revolution, to dispossess the capitalist class, declare the means of production the property of no one, and then to organise production purely and simply for use. This can be done. We don't need any transition period. The productive forces in the world are sufficiently developed to provide abundance, more than abundance, for every single man, woman and child on the planet. All that is missing is the majority socialist consciousness. And as I said right at the beginning, if you don't think that the workers can ever come to a majority socialist consciousness, what you're saying is that socialism is impossible. We are not prepared to draw that conclusion. We think that socialism is possible. We think that socialism is, in fact, the only solution to the problems facing the working class in particular and mankind in general. And in fact, that is what people who are socialists should be doing. Right.
In closing the debate for the CWI, I wish to first return to the main issue of the debate, which was the question of consciousness. And I must say, I've been very disappointed at the fact the SPGB has made no attempt whatsoever all evening to put forward even the slightest theoretical basis for their positions. They've made no attempt to put forward a material basis. They've said simply, if the working class can't become if a majority can't become consciousness, then communism is not possible. We want communism, therefore this is wrong. They've also said that way of getting communism is determined by what communism is going to be like. And both speakers have said that. The second speaker, in amongst all his other clownings about, also repeated this. This position is, as I said before, totally unmaterialist, totally un-Marxist. We are going to achieve socialism depends not on what socialism is going to be like. It depends on the conditions now, the conditions we live under capitalist dictatorship. The arguments we've put forward about the development of consciousness, about the ideas which dominate society being the ideas of the ruling class and the class which does not have an independent means of producing ideas, being subject to these ideas, this has not been answered. Instead, we've had statements such as Marx can rot away in the cemetery and answer this for himself. We don't think it's very useful to drag quotations from Marx into this debate. Well, the reason we drag the statements from Marx into the debate is because we think Marx was right. Because we're putting forward the ideas which he put forward about consciousness and about its material basis. We don't quote him as holy scripture. We've criticized Marx. We've showed he was wrong on certain things which he thought, namely on Parliament. The issue at stake really is the method here. And there's been no defense at all by the SPG of our statement at the start that a method was idealist, and our explanation of how it was idealist. And we repeat that in the summing up. The SPGB has an idealist view of the development of consciousness, which leads to all these other ridiculous fantasies which we've heard during the rest of the debate. In fact, a lot of what was said in defense of SPGB positions was simply emotionalism. There was no attempt at a theoretical defense of their position, and I think that is the most revealing thing of the whole debate. A lot of other things have been said, and it wouldn't be proper to sum up without mentioning them. The question of Parliament. Now, this is a thorn in the side of the SPGB, and I think they're rather sensitive about it. They say it's not necessary to capture Parliament everywhere, or maybe not even in Britain. But, I mean, the publications are full of this. I mean, they say this is in something called Questions of the Day, which I don't know when it was published, but it costs a shilling, so it was before the decimal currency. They say these things they've been talking about the organisation of the state, are a forcible illustration of how necessary it is for workers to obtain control of Parliament before attempting to uproot the existing foundations of society. They further show that the only way to obtain control is the legal one of sending delegates to Parliament. Well, you couldn't get much clearer than that, could you? That's what they said in your publications. Now, we've heard also in the course of the debate an interesting new something we've not read in your press before, that you visualize going to Parliament as not simply sending delegates to Parliament. Oh no, the working class is to be organized outside Parliament as well, in other organizations. There's to be a whole body of organizations, and what's more, these organizations outside Parliament are prepared to use violence if the bourgeoisie resist. In other words, you are talking about military organization outside of Parliament. Well, in the light of what you've written about violence and war and so on, I think these positions should be clarified. We think you're totally contradicting yourself there. I mean, either you go through Parliament and use the state, or you make organisations outside Parliament which are prepared to oppose the force, the force which the military organisations of the bourgeoisie are going to bring on you. You can't really have it both ways. Which brings me on to the transitional programme, which is the subject of much clowning around and so forth. The basic questions, though, are not answered by all this ridiculous attempts to show we're being condescending to the working class. We are approaching real problems, trying to get solutions to them. We've shown how these problems are materialist. You can laugh at them if you want to, but you do so at your own peril, because these problems are not going to go away by making a few jokes around the table here tonight. The quotation we've given from Marx's critique of the Gotha program, we think, puts the issues very clearly, that there is a transitional period between capitalism and communism. And during this transitional period, the majority, the non-productive people in the world, who constitute a majority of the world's population, will have to be integrated into the working class. Now, you might not like this, but this is this is the fact. I mean, we're aiming for a classless society. Everybody has got to be integrated into the working class. And people who do unproductive jobs have got to be integrated into the working class. We've got to find ways of employing them productively for the needs of humanity. And I'm sure we will find ways of doing it. And during this period, the working class state, the working class power, must defend itself. And it's for this reason that we talk about dictatorship of the proletariat and the need for organs to defend the revolution. It's a response to real needs which exist and will arise. Again, in the... Yes. It is necessary to have a police force in the period of transition. It is necessary to have courts. It is necessary...
Conscience?
It's, of course, a state is a state, my friend. You've got to be prepared.
And it's uniform.
Do you grab bullets as well?
Hang on a minute. No, you can't speak to him because he's speaking.
Well, you've got democracy, my friend.
But he's speaking now. We can all speak after he's
finished. You have to come to a close. I'm winding up now. The miners' strike has been mentioned a lot tonight. I feel that we haven't got any satisfactory answers to the questions which are posed by this strike. The July issue of the Socialist Standard had an article on the miners' strike which said three things. It said, A, we support the robbed against the robbers. B, what we must do is propagandize for socialism and contact us if you accept that. And C, it quoted an article from the Socialist Standard in 1905, an article which was written to striking railwaymen, telling them that strikes were pointless, and so was the miners' strike. I mean, that is a summation of... That is a summation of really what has been put forward.
Complete lie.
Please. Comrades, please. If you want to take it up with him afterwards, then by all means do so. But let him finish winding up.
It says strikes can never achieve socialism.
Oh.
That's right.
Or words to that effect, anyway. The point we're trying to make, and we've been trying to make all evening, is that there is an interaction between practical struggle against the system, such as strikes, and the development of consciousness. And it's through this interaction that communism will be brought about. And I think the article clearly indicates what we have been saying about the abstentionism of the SPGB.
Thank you. Okay, that's it.